You're listening to WMFO. That's WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford. Welcome to some more live programming after we just heard some great music from Ear Buddies. I hope I got the name of the show correct. And now we're going to be listening for the next couple hours to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. I'll be your host today. My name is Jeff. And before we get going, we're going to throw on some music. Before we introduce the show, the topics of the show, and so on today, and we hope you'll stay tuned. This is again part of that community slice of WMFO, which is freeform, community based. I usually say freeform, commercial free, community based radio. And we're a little slice of that community based socialist alternative radio. We've been on the air here over a decade, and we are pleased to hear people say, hey, I listen to your show, or I listen to part of your show, and or some of your shows, and et cetera. And right now we're on every other Sunday, and we have been for a while, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. So you're about to get a taste of Socialist Alternative Radio if you're just tuning in. And we're going to throw on some, what do we call this? Green Day? Yes, Green Day. Enjoy.
Down like an Armageddon flame. The shame, the ones who died with
And that was Green Day with Holiday. And I love that song. And we are in a holiday weekend. And it's I'm pleased to report that the idea of Indigenous Peoples Day rather than Columbus Day is increasing around the country. In Seattle, Shama Sawan, a member of Socialist Alternative and a twice elected city councilor recently, re-elected, was instrumental in getting Indigenous Peoples Day passed as a city law. Instead of celebrating Columbus Day, the city officially celebrates Indigenous Peoples Day. That happened last year, the year before, and it's spreading around the country now. And, you know, I can hear conservatives say something about political correctness or something. And, you know, I just want to say, you know, when you really understand what socialism is about and fundamentally changing society to be a real democratic society, bringing democracy into the economy, you can't have a good socialist will say, look, you can't have political freedom in the real sense, you can't have real democracy in the real sense without economic democracy. And economic democracy is real economic freedom. Economic freedom does not mean the freedom to exploit anyone you can because you have lots of money. It doesn't mean you have the freedom to exploit nature and natural resources because you have lots of money that you got through the labor, through exploiting other people's labor or inheritance from people that exploit other people's labor. That's not what economic freedom means. Sorry, libertarians, you're totally crazy, believe it or not. What is economic freedom would be if people actually do the work, us, me, as a worker, would have a say, not only in a local workplace. In fact, that's not even the most important thing. There is a big thing in socialism now about worker co-ops, and that's extremely problematic. They are sometimes they're really good as a sort of a band-aid, a transitional effort in a rotten situation, but they're not going to be the way to, on a mass scale internationally, change society, stop climate destruction, you know, global warming and the destruction of habitat for humanity in terms of the ecology around the world. It's going to take massive democratic planning for human need and for environmental need, not for profit. Which is what capitalism is about without the planning. The anarchy of capitalism is just running rampant around the globe now, despite the Paris Accords and all sorts of other less than Band-Aids. What do you call something less than a Band-Aid? I don't know what to call it. A little cotton swab momentarily applied to a gaping wound. So basically, when it comes to Indigenous Peoples Day, it's not some sort of like, oh, yes, you know, whatever. You know, what's something that's interesting about Indigenous Peoples Day that I'm sure conservatives don't get, and actually a lot of liberals won't get either, is that a lot of parts of the country, including where I grew up, including places I've been to, Native American culture and Native American peoples are deeply entwined in, like, just the basic bedrock of American society. You know, and that's just the way. I mean, there's been an incredible amount of assimilation, and of course, that's not necessarily a good thing. But I'm just saying that the segregation that exists in U.S. society, it does affect Native American communities. But there's also, as with segregation in general, that's been you know, fueled by the government in the United States and banking policies in the United States, and the combination of the two. Housing policies or the lack thereof, and the combination of housing for profit, that kind of segregation, there are always holes blown into it. And it's unfortunately been somewhat effective, very effective, but there's also a lot of cases where it hasn't worked the way the capitalists wanted, and people have still found ways to live together and try to survive. And so a lot of places where you wouldn't expect it, where people seem conservative on the surface, but you bring up Native American issues and they start nodding their heads. They start seeing, yeah, you know, I think that's true. And, you know, I have a Native American blood, so-called, or I know someone that's Native American, as an Indian or whatever. They don't always use the right terminology. You got to get used to that if you're an organizer in the real world. And it's a lot more deeply ingrained, you know, and like this march in Plymouth every year. I think it's getting bigger every year. Day of mourning on Thanksgiving. I just see a lot of Native American issues. You know, look at the Dakota Pipeline, huge multiracial defense of that land by people, so-called outsiders. I love that term. Everyone's an outsider. Even Native Americans were outsiders at one point. Everybody's an outsider. The history of humanity is a history of migration and intermingling of cultures, whether you like it or not. And that's why Indigenous Peoples Day is actually getting, like, in a place like New Hampshire, it's considered a conservative state. It's getting, you know, more interest. I'm not sure it's going to, you know, carry. It's been passed in one town, Durham, I believe. But that's very significant, you know, and there's true of a lot of issues. There's a lot of issues that don't fit into the conservative liberal paradigm. And it might surprise a lot of conservatives to understand that socialists really have nothing in common with liberalism. I mean, revolutionary socialists, really nothing in common with liberalism, although it may seem so on the surface. Yeah, sure, there are some certain issues there might be agreement on temporarily. How to fund them is a huge thing. Liberals are always like, hey, workers, swallow those taxes. It's good for you. I can tell you as a worker, I swallowed too many taxes. It's time for rewrite the tax code, not in the way that Trumpo's talking about, but in the way that it used to be, and even more so. We do the work, let the idle rich pay the taxes as we're transitioning, as we're hopefully changing society fundamentally. In the interim, we need heavy, heavy, heavy taxation on the super rich, heavy taxation on the big corporations. And through that, fund, you know, socialized medicine, you know, Medicare for all, single payer, really socialized medicine is what we need. And that just means, you know, free medical care for all, no role for insurance companies or profit making. And why should there be? Can you imagine, you know, if religion was real and somebody like, you know, stood up as the head of an insurance company or like a hospital. I don't know if you noticed, but hospitals are merging like crazy right now. The tendency towards monopolization, which is always a trend, a tendency under capitalism. Marx talked about this. Other Marxists talk about this. It is there. It's so obvious. And right now it's happening in the hospital industry as that's been deregulated since the Carter administration. There's been deregulation of healthcare. And basically the hospitals are monopolizing up and just, you know, making billions of dollars off of sick people. And, you know, if there was a God of retribution, of justice, I'm looking for those biblical words and they're not coming to me. So I haven't read the Bible in a long time. I used to be forced to read the Bible, but I don't read it anymore. If you look at the situation with something like people bragging, right, at least in the business media, at least in the corporate media for business people, and if I ever say the word entrepreneur on this show and actually mean it, you know, you're allowed to call in and just ask for my resignation because that's such a con job. They put a pretty word on what is basically crap, doo-doo, things that I can't say on the radio. They put a pretty word on capitalism, which is based on exploitation and greed, and a capitalist, who is greedy and exploiting other people, whether they know it or not. And I'm not saying every rich person's evil. That's not true. But what they're a part of, their class is, their social class is doing evil. And that's all that matters. And that's why every once in a while there's a rich person that says, goes crazy and gives it all away and says, I don't want to be a part of this anymore. Very rare, of course. It's nice to go out to dinner every night and have a nice meal, and nice to not have to work and listen to the crap your boss tells you and so on. But anyway, back to the point that basically there's a lot of issues that cut through that conservative liberal paradigm based on class, based on commonalities of struggle against repression, against sexism, against all sorts of things. And people are, you know, don't fall into line, you know, and taxation is one that's emerging where Trumpo will lie, basically. He's basically lying to working people, saying, hey, you're going to do well here. You're going to do really well here. You know how he talks really fast, by the way, and doesn't say a heck of a lot in detail. I've noticed that's more and more popular among politicians. You know, Marty Walsh does that here in Boston, and Menino before him did that, the mayor of Boston. They talk really fast. They make sure they got the Boston accent. They drop their R's a lot. And you're sitting there saying, well, wait a minute. Somebody just asked you about rent and that they can't afford their rent. They're about to be kicked out of their home. And and all you say is, yeah, we got a lot of programs now. And that's what it sounds like. And you know, by the way, that's why a lot of people are over, completely over the other paradigm, the duopoly, the Democrats, Republicans, Republicans, Democrats, completely over that, completely. And we're going to get into that in a second. But back to the conservative liberal paradigm on taxes, where the liberals will basically be like, yeah, workers, you know, you're going to get a lot out of this. So you just let your taxes go up again for the millionth time. So you get a lot out of this, like education, right? What kind of insane country allows its education to be funded primarily through property taxes? That is a recipe for inequality, but also a recipe for actually homelessness for, and people being forced out of communities. You know, you move into a community, you move into a place, and if the taxes are going up for education, which in a lot of places they are, depends on what the you know, base of the communities. There's a lot of businesses, then they might not be going up as high, but they're still going up. But anyway, going up at all for some people is too much, you know, and there are some programs here or there to ameliorate that. But a lot of people are just like, I can't afford to live in this neighborhood. I can't afford to live in this area, this town, this city, not just because of higher rents, not just because of mortgages, rotten mortgages. And those two things are certainly huge, huge problems and have to be addressed immediately and have to be fought against immediately and are by people here and there. We need a much bigger movement. But on top of that is just property taxes, and hardly anyone talks about it. You know, I mean, I remember reading a lot of education stuff about U.S. education when I was reading a lot of books by Jonathan Kozol, who I'd recommend, K-O-Z-O-L. And he would talk about it, property taxes, insane, you know, to base funding on this. I don't remember him clearly spelling out an alternative, but I have been a while since I've been reading his stuff. But basically, you know, as in other countries, the federal government should just pay for education, you know. Oh, where's the money going to come from? Well, it's going to come from taxing the crap out of the super rich, which right now they're getting away with murder and hardly being taxed at all, and taxing the big corporations, which, oh, they go around saying without a qualifier, big corporations pay 34% tax, or 33 or 34% tax in the United States, and this is one of the highest taxation rates in the world. Well, number one, the United States is, the by capitalist standards, the most powerful, richest country in the world. Okay, so maybe they should be number one in taxation too. Let's leave that aside for a second. That's too logical. Let's go down to the fact that basically big corporations don't actually pay the 33%, the 34%. There's so many ways out of it that the effective tax rate, that's what it's called for people that don't want to say, you know, corporate tax evasion or corporate breaking the law, corporations breaking the law end up paying blank, or corporate or laws written for corporations. They end up paying 18, 17. It keeps dropping every time they study it. Every time they look at it, the corporation's paying less and less. And once in a while, you will hear on the corporate media an example of some big company like General Electric or somebody that didn't pay any taxes, right? ExxonMobil paid zero taxes last year. What happened? I mean, that's not a direct quote. I haven't researched that lately, but I'm using that as an example. And so this happens, and everyone's surprised. How'd they get away with that? Well, a lot of them are getting away with it. And the ones that don't get away with that still pay a token. Then you hear about offshoring. You know, they keep their money in other countries. Trumpo's talking about doing something about this. But if you look closely at what he's talking about, it doesn't necessarily mandate or legalize or place some sort of legal restriction on still keeping the money in other countries, you know, that might have a lower tax rate or for other reasons they keep the money there. The famous, you know, offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands or the Swiss banks and all that. But there's also countries like Ireland where the government, the capitalist, pro-capitalist government, the government run by the capitalists, which is every government under capitalism, but even more so under Ireland recently, they've just prostituted themselves to the big corporations. Yeah, come on in. We won't charge you any taxes. I can't do an Irish accent. Anyway, so we'll charge you so little, you won't even notice. And that's what's going on. So then it falls. It's the topsy-turvy world. It's Alice in Wonderland, where now, compared to the 50s, 60s, 70s, now working people in the United States are paying most of the taxes. Huge chunks. Trump's plan has this wonderful little surprise in it of increasing taxes for the poorest people in the country while lowering them for the richest people. You might have heard that one. Right? It's true. But it's even more insidious. Getting rid of the inheritance tax, for example, the estate tax, Getting rid of that is complete crap. Oh my goodness. I mean, can you imagine? They amass wealth off exploiting our labor and off of, destroying nature. And then they give that big chunk to the next, to their children without any tax on it even. I mean, that just guarantees inequality increasing exponentially from generation to generation, as it already is, but it will be even worse. So, the next time the liberals say, suck it up, workers, take those taxes. No. And a lot of liberals, at least the pundits of liberalism, the intellectual liberals that you'll hear here and there, and I use the term loosely, intellectual, they are tend to be upper middle class. They can take a little hit on their taxes and think they're doing something good. And I do want them to take a hit on that. I want the upper middle class people to pay more taxes too. But I'm really concerned about the super rich, the big corporations. They need to pay tons more in taxes. They've gotten away with murder. And some people have tracked this. I mean, I remember reading stuff in the 80s where people, after Reagan, after the smoke cleared on the Carter and Reagan administrations, people wrote stuff, wait a minute, the tax system has just flipped. Have you noticed that? I remember the Philadelphia Inquirer or some paper in Philadelphia had these writers that were very popular in the late 80s, early 90s that wrote a series of basically books just studying journalists, just like doing some research, studying how the whole tax situation had flipped and how that was really hurting working people, you know? So anyone that's got the cliche, whatever, if you haven't broken out of that conservative liberal paradigm yet, or you call yourself somewhere in the middle or something, please understand, socialists, at least, real socialists that really want to change things are not enamored of liberalism at all, and don't necessarily see liberalism as closer to socialism because things are so fluid. I mean, there have been polls done about attitudes towards the word socialist, right? Or the word socialism. And we've talked about these polls on the show before. And the information is pretty good. It's in the sense of you have people each year starting back, and they started to do this in like 2010, 2012. Each year, there's more and more people with a favorable attitude towards socialism, with outright majorities among the youth, among so-called millennials, outright majorities among people of color oftentimes. And but then here's the point. Here's the one I wanted to tell you about. It's really funny. Democrats have a high, those that say they vote Democrat have a high, usually a high percentage, but not not a majority. I mean, that, I think it was like 30 something. I mean, I'm sorry, 40 something percent, something like that. I have to double check on that. And then, but the funny thing is, they'd get people that said they were Republicans that would give a good response to the word socialism, and it was like 30% of Republicans had a favorable response to the word socialism. Oh, that's interesting. So how much do those terms really mean, in American politics? So to say that that you're against liberalism, what I'm getting at means I'm not against liberals. I'm against the ideas associated with liberalism that you can just tweak capitalism a little bit and stop the internal contradictions of the system and the endemic waste, violence, and everything else that goes along with capitalism, the exploitation daily, hourly, minute, every second, and say, we're just going to regulate businesses a little bit and then everything will be fine, when it hasn't, it isn't. and that's not the way to go forward at all. So today's show, we're going to talk about some things that we're not going to hit like all the headline points. I dislike that pressure that, all these huge events have happened and are very important, very much worth talking about. But what are some other things happening that then are going to get buried in the so-called news cycle? And as I've mentioned many times about this show, Socialist Alternative Radio, if you're just tuning in, we are all about not just alternative news from a left-wing perspective. That's a little part of it. It's not just an alternative analysis from a Marxist socialist perspective. That's a big part of it. But a bigger part of it is that's great. Okay. A larger part of it is trying to convince you as a person, no matter where you come from, no matter what your racial construct is, whatever your ethnic background is, whatever your age, to consider looking into socialism more and actually getting involved in the socialist movement, you know, actually joining Socialist Alternative, perhaps, or at least checking out different socialist groups and analyses and so on, and not being afraid of the word socialism. And, you know, if you go on Facebook and enter virtual reality world of political debate, which is always very truncated and simplistic, you'll one of the first things you'll run into when you start to consider socialism is some absolutely brilliant conservative, and I'm being sarcastic, of course, will write in and say, well, it didn't work. It being socialism work, I don't know what they mean by that. Capitalism, do you say capitalism works when someone, you know, gets up on a tower and shoots up, you know, 60 people and wounds hundreds more? Is it working? I mean, when you are producing mass murderers like any other commodity under capitalism, is capitalism working if there's such horrible inequality that there are people going hungry in the richest country in the world, and that there are so many homeless, thousands and thousands and thousands of homeless people all over the place? Was that what you call working when for every homeless person there's 6 or 7 empty houses? And if you added commercial properties, you might have like maybe 20, who knows, spaces available for the homeless that would more than house the homeless if there's any sort of plan. Just the waste of talent and creativity. You know, I was just listening to this I think it was National Propaganda Radio on my way in. There's a movie coming out in the fall I'm very interested in called, I think it's called Love Vincent, something like that. And it's about Vincent van Gogh and his life and his paintings told through a little story, a line about, you know, why did he die exactly? But the methodology is to take every frame of the film and do an oil painting of each frame. So it's a type of animation, but using actually really oil paint and actual really painting. And they had to hire hundreds of oil painters to do this. And they sent out, the call, wherever. These were European filmmakers, one British, one Polish, who are a couple. They sent out the call in various places. I guess they set up shop in Athens and also in Poland somewhere, and to start making it. And so thousands of people responded, and they were able to get like 600 people that were absolutely amazingly talented, including one guy. They said, we got this genius who was an auto mechanic. And he never had been able to do any, you know, get any formal training or anything. You know, multiply that times a million under a socialist, in a socialist society, democratic socialist society, you would have such talent that that would be able to actually, society would actually be able to use in a good sense or be a part of. People would be able to develop their talents, whereas under capitalism, it's the vaunted, you know, competition. But competition is a very unfair game, you know, where the rich get the access to the best training, the best teaching, and everything else. The time to actually work on creative pursuits rather than having to put your time into surviving, et cetera. I mean, you get a sense of the horrible waste of capitalism, you know, and this is not something that can be tweaked by a few regulations. This is something built into the system that won't go away until we have a democratic socialist system. Now, how do you get there? So, I'm sorry, getting back to the it doesn't work thing. So then the brilliant conservative will say, see, it doesn't work. If you push them, it means socialism, Russia, whatever. Well, that is such an absurd argument. You know, like today I saw one on Facebook where they actually mentioned more than just Russia. They mentioned some small countries in Africa and so on that had been socialist for about 5 minutes, you know, when they threw off their colonial masters. And the point is that basically socialism is not something that is done in an experimental realm, in a clean lab somewhere. With, you know, your nicely washed and regulated petri dishes, and you're growing, you're germinating socialism here and there, and seeing, gee, did that really flourish? Can we really plant that now? Nor is it in a you know, greenhouse somewhere where you're basically growing socialism in ideal conditions? Of course not. You know, I could take the metaphor further, but what I'm getting at is, should be obvious. Socialism, wherever it battles its way to the surface of anti-capitalist movements and all sorts of resistance and rebellion against the unfairness of capitalism, including people that think their capitalism isn't the problem, but it really is. What happens is that socialism is immediately attacked. So let's take the example of the Russian Revolution. A lot of people don't know that and the minute the Bolsheviks got into power through the Soviets, as part of the Soviets, these big workers' councils, a very democratic movement and revolution, unlike the propaganda against it, talks about. And there's some in the new issue of Socialist Alternative, which we'll get into today. There's a little blurb here that gets into that. Says, the Russian Revolution is still inspiring socialists 100 years later. 100 years ago, the October Revolution under the leadership of Lenin and Trotsky opened a new chapter in history. By overthrowing capitalism, Russia leapt forward in terms of social and economic equality, legalizing marriage equality, granting universal suffrage, and democratically organizing the economy. The Russian Revolution inspired socialist revolts in its wake internationally. When workers and factories formed committees and sent deputies to the local and citywide councils called Soviets in Russia, they were also reorganizing production and distribution. By discussing and deciding priorities democratically in the workplace committees and Soviets, workers' councils, Russian society was arranged for the needs of the Russian working people instead of their previous focus, the imperialist World War I and the profits of the big banks, etc. So now this gives you a glimpse into what I'm talking about. So the Russian Revolution unleashes democracy at a level more direct and more unheard of than ever before, because it brings democracy into the economy and economic decisions through the mass workers' councils of workers and peasants called the Soviets. Almost immediately, starting like in this was in 1917, the revolution happened in two stages. Then in 1918, it was continuing, getting deeper. Late 1918 into 1919, and starting in 1919. There's a civil war emerges, but you know, it's not much of a problem at first. But then in 1919, all these imperialist armies, all these armies from the rich capitalist countries invade Russia. How many of our listeners know about that? They invade Russia. Look it up. Operation Archangel, it was called. The United States, Britain, France, they go in and they take over part of the country. They feed weapons, propaganda materials, everything you can think of to the remnants of the White Army. These are the rich people that got kicked out. Those pro-Tsarist people, the anti-Semitic, you know, Cossacks that did pogroms, the absolute dregs of Russian society, not in terms of poor, not at all, but in terms of the richest in Russian society, and whoever they could hire, and whatever mercenaries they could get to continue the old repressive regime. That had refused to, you know, leave World War I and so on. So you have the White Army funded from outside, primarily, goes back and launches a vicious civil war with the backing of all these armies, with the backing of an economic blockade around Russia, with the backing of the an enormous propaganda offensive internationally, with trying to isolate Russia politically. Et cetera, et cetera. It's not like the experiment was left. When you say it didn't work, you say, no, it was destroyed. It was mutated. It was forced to mutate into Stalinism. Look at the Paris Commune in 1871, a very brief flowering of socialism, just the seed sort of just opening up, if you want to continue that metaphor, and basically two capitalist armies that had been at each other's throats over territory, and the French army and the German army, suddenly, when faced with a workers' revolt in Paris, suddenly they become the best of allies, and the Germans provide cover for the French army to go back in and massacre as many people as they could that had supported the Commune, and by sheer terror, destroy that so-called experiment. It didn't work? No, it was destroyed. And every time I go to Paris, which is never in the last 15 years, but when I was younger and I would drag some money together because I lived there one time. Every time I would go there, I would go buy a dozen roses near Père Lachaise Cemetery, and I'd go to the Mur de Fédéral, the Wall of the Communards, and I would lay down those roses, and there would be other roses there, and there'd be banners there, and all sorts of commemoration for about 800 to 900 men, women, and children that were massacred. They were the last of the Communards massacred by the French army to stop socialism, a version of socialism. Go to the Spanish Revolution, the Spanish Civil War. We're still the fight for independence in Catalan is part of it still, you know, goes back really its roots the 1930s and beyond and further back even. The Spanish Revolution or so-called Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, parts of the country liberated, experiments started in doing non-capitalist economies and so on. And was that left alone to flower? Was it given help? Were any of these examples given help by the capitalists? No. Did the capitalists even help each other when a new capitalist power tried? No. Most of the world is dominated by a few capitalist countries because it's not like they welcome the new capitalists into the gang. That gang is at each other's throats in certain ways economically. But when they really unite is when somebody threatens their system. And then all of a sudden they will cooperate somewhat and they will try to destroy. So in the Spanish Revolution, you had bombing from fascist Germany, Guernica, for example. You had bombing from, you had Italy, the fascist government of Mussolini in Italy helping the fascists. Franco going from Morocco down into Spain with a fascist army. And the United States helping the fascists secretly and publicly not doing anything. And basically the United States government. And basically you have a an eventual defeat of the Spanish Revolution, a bloodbath, many, many revolutionaries in exile, hunted down in the countries they go to try to escape the fascist pogrom, fascist revenge and murder that's happening to them in Spain, happening to the people in Spain. And then a dictatorship all the way up to, what, 75 or something like that, or 79? I can't remember when Franco finally bit the dust. And so, again, Spanish Revolution, the experiment didn't work. What do you mean work? What do you mean experiment? It had no chance. It was surrounded. Now, so then, you know, the clever conservative or liberal might say, well, that's the problem with socialism is that, you know, it's not strong enough. The capitalism will always crush it. Well, hey, those were battles in an ongoing class war. And as long as there's capitalism, there's going to be people trying to overthrow it. And because they have to, they see the survival of humanity based on that, based on transition to socialism. And it keeps popping up again and again, just when they think they've finished it off with all their propaganda, all their it didn't work arguments. Oh, it's come back again. Wait a minute. I'm here. I'm at a mic here talking about socialism. I'm a socialist. I'm a revolutionary socialist. Where's that come from? You know, am I the only one or there are millions of others around the world? Oh, there are, you know. Check out socialistalternative.org. You want to check out socialistworld.net, the Committee for Workers International. Check out many countries with socialist parties, really or not. I mean, they could have the name and they might not be socialist, but there are some that are striving that way. And where parties that had the name socialist that went to the right and gave up the fight, like the Socialist Party of Spain, PSOE, you have Podemos, a movement filled with socialists, coming up in the wake of PSOE. You have in the Catalan independence movement right now, socialists. Now, they're not controlling the movement, but they're part of it. And it doesn't go away because capitalism doesn't just drift away or get any better, really. Capitalism gets worse in terms of the effect internationally. So socialists would say, well, if you think socialism is too weak to overthrow capitalism, why is it keep reemerging against enormous odds and enormous repression, outright murder? I mean, pick the country, Iran, when the Islamic fundamentalists came to power after the Shah, they murdered thousands and thousands of communists and socialists, terrorized the country to the point where the left is driven completely underground or non-existent. They've set up a government where they vet candidates so no real socialists can run for anything. And yet, I've met Iranian socialists. You know, I've met people who are that they fear that the imams, the big theocracy, capitalist theocracy in Iran fears socialism, even though they've created a river of blood through murder and so on to try to stop it. It's still in the back of their minds. It's still there. The Middle East seems fairly devoid of a you know, real mass democratic socialism movement because there was such murder of it, repression of it from the big capitalist powers who were more concerned with oil, of course, and access to oil, control of oil than anything else. So yet it hasn't eradicated it, that it still exists there. The point is that the conditions of capitalism in an objective way create the conditions for socialism. And a lot of Marxists and socialist theoreticians write about that. You know, you have socialized production on a mass scale. You got more people living in cities than ever before. Everything points to the fact that that there is enough abundance and superabundance of commodities, goods and services produced, that instead of wasting them, instead of them only being done for profit, instead of them being cut down when they're not profitable enough and destroyed, productive forces destroyed, people could democratically control them, create a network internationally to make democratic decisions for human need, for environmental sustainability, and not for profit. And then to figure out how to distribute things equitably and create a society where people, humanity, will actually be able to survive, and climate change won't wreck the planet for us, based on capitalism, exacerbating the climate change, making it worse, or creating the conditions for climate change in many cases. But just in terms of like all other problems that capitalism engenders, in terms of the war and the threat of war. I mean, who's been talking about nuclear war lately? And all of a sudden, there's a Nobel Prize, which is very ironic because, you know, the history of the Nobel Prize, the dynamite manufacturer and all that, giving a Nobel Prize to a group fighting against nuclear weapons, saying that nuclear weapons should be eliminated, and they're not. Here's 2017, nuclear weapons are not eliminated. They're proliferating, and in North Korea, there's the possibility of a nuclear weapon triggering an international nuclear exchange or a national or exchange nuclear exchange. This is insane that people that this still exists, but it's not because people are allowed to sort of vote. Yes, I agree still with nuclear weapons and so on. No, actually, people are not allowed to vote on things like that. And that's what socialism is about, is you bring democracy to a real grassroots level in terms of economic decisions, in terms of, workers' governments where there'll be much bigger, broader right of recall, etc. All sorts of ways to make democracy deeper that are not trying under capitalism, but capitalism fears them desperately. I mean, look at the kind of defense of the Constitution, like it's some sort of like laws somehow come down from God or there's some sort of natural phenomena, you know, rather than reflecting the interests of the ruling class at the time that wrote those laws. So you have things about the Constitution and so on that are considered absolutely sacrosanct. And they didn't do it that way. The Founding Fathers didn't do it that way. Yeah, well, the Founding Fathers, you know, were wiping out Native Americans and using slave labor to for their wealth and their power. So I'd say their laws are completely wrong, actually, you know. And if they stumbled on some sort of early form of democracy, well, by this time it should be a lot deeper and a lot more profound. And going back to the things that capitalism engenders, the threat of nuclear war not going away, racism not going away, sexism not going away. Yeah, gains can be made, but they can be taken away, you know. Like if you look at women's rights, for example, from an international perspective, it's not looking good, right? Because you have certain societies where there's been a complete backward seizing, a complete reactionary destruction of women's rights in certain countries that are like, you know, religious theocracies under capitalism or just using fundamentalist religions. And I am thinking, I'm thinking of Islamic fundamentalism, but there's also other fundamentalisms out there we don't hear much about that are doing the same thing to women as they grow in power, as any sort of change is blocked. People often look into religion as a way out somehow, or religious organizations exploit their frustration in various ways, and that's okay for the capitalists. So they tend to gain more power in certain circumstances than a movement around socialism can at this particular time. Although in the past socialist movements were very big in countries that now they've been driven underground or murdered out of existence temporarily. The situation is that with a lot of if you start to get interested in socialism, you're going to hear a lot of cliched arguments right away. It didn't work. Just think about it. It wasn't allowed to work, but it's an ongoing battle an ongoing war where certain battles are won and lost, but the battles continue because they have to, because there are certain things built into the foundations of capitalism that are going to destroy humanity, most likely. There's no guarantee of socialism, but if there is not socialism on an international scale, most likely capitalism will not leave the world untouched or leave the world habitable for human life. And even if that sort of cataclysmic events don't happen in terms of climate change, in terms of nuclear war and so on, just the social indices of capitalism, the continued inequality and deepening inequality, the continued places in the world where capitalism, we're talking about something working, go to sub-Saharan Africa and tell me, does capitalism work there? I mean, there are places in the world where capitalism can't gain a foothold in a certain sense because there's no way to make money there. If you go to a region that capitalism has destroyed so utterly that the capitalists themselves can't figure out a way to make profits there, they just ignore it. And, of course, it falls into some sort of like warlord barter economy for a time until maybe some capitalist comes along or imperialism wants some stability in the region and sets some sort of, dictatorship up or something. There are plenty of countries in the underdeveloped world, underdeveloped on purpose, by capitalism, by imperialism, plenty of countries in the underdeveloped world where the idea of if you say capitalism works, you just be laughed away. I mean, it just doesn't. It's just not working. And even countries that you think it's working. Did you know Thailand is a dictatorship right now? Did you actually know that? Did you know that in the Philippines, there's this crazy ruler who's got the government. He's got extra judicial murder going on in the streets. You just find a lot of examples of places that are called democracy and they're really dictatorships. Look at Saudi Arabia. I mean, this is a royalistic dictatorship, where the fact that women are going to be able to drive cars in the near future is applauded as a huge step forward. I mean, it is a step forward, but I mean, come on, where does that mean society is at? And this is considered an ally of the United States and a place where the United States government throws lots of money into to keep the oil flowing. Egypt, dictatorship. Second recipient, biggest recipient of U.S. aid, U.S. foreign aid, U.S. government foreign aid. First is Israel, second is Egypt, right? Why? Well, that gives you a base of control, especially Israel, over the oil in the Middle East, even though Israel itself is not a big oil producer. It's its strategic position in the region, you just go down a list of other countries in any part of the world practically and find out that capitalism doesn't equal democracy. Capitalism isn't working if you have any kind of humane definition of working. And then, what's the alternative? Well, there is an alternative, and it's democratic socialism. And the fact that people will argue to their death, claiming there is no alternative, even if it's built around them, that's because they have a vested interest in keeping the exploitation going. I'm really concerned with that more than anything else, because it enriches them, or they're just very deluded and haven't really taken the time and won't take the time to to care about other people. Basically, there won't be if there's a revolutionary movement internationally for socialism. It's not like everyone's going to embrace it. I mean, that's just not going to happen, and it's not like the capitalists won't try and stop it with violence. That will be the case. And the question is, though, we are the many and they are the few, and that violence, that those attempts can be overcome and are overcome. I mean, again, go back to the Russian Revolution. For a time, successful, and the revolution did survive the civil war, but just barely in Russia. But for a time, successful, and all the repressive apparatus of that regime at the time, which was formidable for its time. It had been conducting World War One. It had Cossacks. It had paramilitary groups of all sorts, right-wing paramilitary groups. It had a lot ready to destroy any revolutionary movements, and had destroyed previous revolutionary movements, like in 1905 in Russia and so on. And none of it worked. It just didn't work when it came to the people, the revolution getting deep enough among the working class that people couldn't be stopped. So anyway, this Russian Revolution talk is not accidental. It's very, very important to study revolutions, both successful and not successful, under revolutions against capitalism, and for socialists or anyone that wants to consider socialism. But this is also the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, and so a lot of material in Socialist Alternatives publications, in socialistworld.net, the CWI publications, there is a lot of material about the Russian Revolution. And what I started to read to you was from the newest issue of Socialist Alternatives newspaper, the October issue, issue number 37, that dating back not to the first issue of... You mentioned the name of the paper being Socialist Alternative. Before that, it was called Justice. And the next issue in November is going to have a lot on the Russian Revolution, and a 4-page insert on the Russian Revolution. This issue has some introductory paragraphs about it, and that I just read a brief excerpt from. And what I really want to get to you also, though, is the back page of the newspaper, an important part of any paper. And you can read these articles online at socialistalternative.org, or most of them, is the an article by, let's see, got to get the author's name right, give credit where credit is due, Andy Moxley. Andy wrote this, is out in Minneapolis helping the Ginger Jensen campaign that we mentioned on the air before. You hear the newspaper rattling around, huh? It's going old school today, reading it off the paper, actually. So as we mentioned in previous shows, Ginger Jensen is a member of Socialist Alternative, an independent socialist, independent meaning not part of the Democratic Party, Republican. There are people that claim to be socialists that also support the Democratic Party or use Democratic Party ballot lines and that sort of thing, and that is all... As far as I'm concerned, that makes them not socialists, but they still might claim the title for some reason. But this is a real socialist running for office in Minneapolis, hoping to accomplish the feat that was accomplished by Shama Sawant and Socialist Alternative in Seattle, where Shama Sawant was elected in 2013 and reelected last year. And is doing great work with using the position of city council to build mass movements within Seattle for all sorts of issues, whether it's Indigenous Peoples Day, as we talked about earlier, or the $15 minimum wage that passed, the first big city in the country passed in Seattle. That was led by Shama Sawant, Socialist Alternative, and there was a broad coalition of unions and others behind that as well. There's been, like, for example, they wanted to build a big police bunker in Seattle, costing, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. I forget the exact figures, but it was pretty horrific. And Shama led a campaign, with others, and Socialist Alternative, of course. When I say Shama, it's sort of shorthand for Shama and Socialist Alternative, to stop that building of the police bunker and take some of that money, or take as much of that money as we could get and use it for public housing or low-cost housing. And there was eventually a settlement that the bunker was not built, and some of the money was used for low-income housing, or to be used for that. There was also the issues of a slumlord named Carl Haglund that was just creating, like, horrible, owned a lot of buildings, creating horrible conditions for people in the buildings, mostly immigrants. And Shama led a fight to clean that up, and that was successful to the point where she's facing a lot of attacks and pressure from the real estate developer capitalists in Seattle. Anyway, you get the point. I mean, I could go on, and we have mentioned on the show before that a lot has been done in a very short time by having a socialist elected, a socialist who can't be bought, a socialist Shama Sawant who takes only the average wage of workers in her in the area she represents. So Shama's taking home around $40,000, and the rest of the Seattle City Council is taking in $120,000+. Shama takes the rest of that money, donates it to social justice causes and organizations, and basically that alone, which is it is a rule for socialist alternative people that are considering running for office, that are put forward by socialist alternative, that's always how they're going to serve. They're always going to serve in their position as always going to pledge and serve as only taking the average worker's wage while in office. Why? It keeps you in touch with the working people you're representing, the vast majority that you're representing. But also, it separates the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. It separates the people who are serious about doing being in office for building movements for the people, for socialism, versus people that want to make a career out of politics. I mean, if I made $120,000 in 1 year, I'd probably feel like I was set for life. I mean, I wouldn't be, right? I have a family, but I'm like, I would feel like, wow, this is amazing. And if you look at the statistics, a lot of people don't know this in the United States. They're very, especially here in Boston, when there's a lot of rich people running around. The number, a lot, is when you do the math, okay, when you do the proportions of people making X amount of money in the United States as a whole, right? Not where they're concentrated in certain urban areas, New York, you know, Manhattan, Back Bay, Boston, wherever. If you take that to the vast geographic area of the United States, the vast population of the United States, what is approaching 400 million or something. The number of people that make that kind of money, $120,000 a year, is infinitesimal. It is like mathematically tiny. I can't even wrap my head around it. And it's so small. And I like research a lot of this stuff. So it's tiny, tiny, tiny number of people. And yet they think nothing of like pretending it's not a big deal. Oh, yeah, yeah. So-and-so makes $120,000 a year. Or there's cops in Boston that through their, doing the what do you call those things, the extra work they do off duty, to where they direct traffic or they do security in a store or something like that, forget the word for that, they end up making like the highest paid Boston people on the public payroll, so to speak, the highest paid were like detectives, Boston cops, with overtime and all this other stuff. And it was hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm sorry, you know, you might do the old Boston accent, you know, but whoever you are, the head of the Boston cops, I forget his name, but you're making the money of the Rockefellers and the Gateses and the Clintonses and all the Richies. You know, you're not with us. Sorry, you want to pretend away, but you're not. You're now elevated to a lifestyle that I can see where you get your energy from. I can see instead of the whip, it's the carrot for you. Okay, whatever. But we want to elect people that are not getting $120,000 a year, or in Minneapolis, Ginger Jensen, if she took the full wage, it would be, I forget, like $85,000, $90,000 or something. I have to double check that. She will take the average wage of the people she represents. By the way, before we go more into like socialist running for office, that sort of thing, just want to say that this is WMFO. That's WMFO in Medford. Tufts Freeform Radio at 91.5 FM. Go to WMFO.org to listen by computer. But really have to get out that WMFO Medford thing. Hope everyone heard that really clear. We're going to get to some public service announcements in a minute. But I want to talk a little more about Ginger Jensen. If you get the online socialistalternative.org version or the paper version of Socialist Alternative's newspaper, you'll see a really good article, two articles actually, on Ginger Jensen. I'll just read a couple excerpts here. By Andy Moxley, in Minneapolis, Socialist Alternative member Ginger Jensen's city council campaign is shaking the political establishment to its core. Running on a strong socialist platform, Ginger is fighting for bold policies like rent control and taxes on big developers and millionaires to fund affordable housing and social programs. The campaign is a way to build a powerful grassroots movement of the 99% to push back against the corporate agenda in City Hall. And what's interesting about Socialist Alternative in Minneapolis and Ginger Jensen's campaign is that that Ginger was so Ginger started out, she hasn't been in Socialist Alternative all that long, and she started out, you know, like a lot of people, working. She was doing, you know, waitressing jobs and stuff like that. Then she got involved with Socialist Alternative, and she's a very good organizer, and she was elected to be the head of 15 Now in Minneapolis. That's a organization that was started in Seattle to fight for a $15 minimum wage, just like what is the name of the other group, the SEIU.